Good morning, Paradox class. It's good to see you this morning. We have online people, welcome. All the online people, we have Hugh Ross speaking today, and we have the book table set up on the side for anybody who wants a book of Hugh Ross's. And so we'll have Hugh up in a minute. It's my last Sunday here. I'm moving to Idaho, so I won't be in the class. I've been here for about 10 years, I think, and helping in the background with the cameras and stuff. So just wanted to say goodbye to everybody, and we should have an exciting class today. All righty, here you go, Hugh. Any announcements?
Yeah, as far as other announcements go, we talked last week about maybe taking a week off during Christmas. What's going to work for me is I'll be here on December 22nd, but I'm actually got an event in December 29th. So we'll skip the 29th, but we will be here on the 22nd of December. And for those of you that are new here, we've been in a series on Noah's flood. It's based on a book I've just completed on Noah's flood. It actually has a title now, Noah's Flood Revisited, New Depths of Insight from Science and Scripture. And so I'm actually working on the final edits of that book right now. And there are a few chapters in Noah's Flood in this book that came out a few years ago, Navigating Genesis. We have some copies over there at the book table. And if you run into people who are interested in this, anyone can get a free chapter of the book by going to reasons.org/Ross. Well, last week we mentioned how no matter where you go in the world, there's these flood stories. And what does this really tell us about Noah's flood? But just to quickly review what we covered at the end of last week, we noted that there's over 300 distinct flood legends in the ancient cultures of the world, in which all but a few people are wiped out by the flood. This is documented by the German historian Johann Rehm in his book, the English translation is The Flood in Legend and Genesis. But then there's another book that came out, also in the 20th century, where they said there's 300 distinct legends, flood stories among the natives of North and South America alone. So any of all you look at is the New World of North and South America. You can document over 300 distinct different flood stories and flood legends amongst the ancient peoples of North and South America. And then there's also 270 distinct written legends, legends in written literature of the ancient flood people, ancient people groups about Noah's flood. And the pervasiveness of these flood stories has been noted throughout all of church history. And there's more than double the number of flood stories there are creation stories. So as ubiquitous as the creation stories are in the ancient cultures of the world, to a much greater degree, we see these pervasive stories of a flood that wiped out all but a few human beings. And this was noted as far back as the first century AD in the written history. The Jewish historian Flavius Josephus wrote this in his book, Antiquities of the Jews. He said, quote, "Now all writers of the barbarian histories make mention of the flood and of this ark, among whom is Berosus the Chaldean, Hieronius the Egyptian, also who wrote the Phoenician Antiquities, and Manasses, and a great many more make mention of the same." And then if you go forward to the Protestant Reformation, we have this written in 1695. "The unanimous tradition of a universal deluge amongst all the most ancient Gentile nations, proving that the great devastation and the havoc of the deluge made both of the earth itself and of generally of mankind." And that is written by John Woodward, Account of the Universal Deluge. And in the 20th century, early 20th century, we have this statement, "The only alternative to the theory that there was one single flood catastrophe that impacted humanity is there were many separate local floods. This alternative has this chief objection, namely that the remarkable similarity in the deluge legends is not accounted for. And you know, I've got a collection of books on the flood written by agnostic and atheist historians and scientists, and this is what they all say. Well, the explanation for all these flood stories is that floods are common. If you wait long enough, there's a flood even in desert regions. And so they're saying the explanation for all these 300, 400 plus flood stories is that, you know, they all get to experience a different kind of flood, and therefore this is not in any way support for what the Bible says. It's just a bunch of local floods affecting a bunch of local individuals at different times in human history. But it does fail to account for the incredible similarity amongst these 400 different flood stories. And so I've got a table here which basically shows you the degree of similarity. And what we notice in these flood stories, 99% of the 300 to 400 stories actually speak about a great depth of water, more than 100 meters of water depth impacting the people that were alive at that time. So that's more than 330 feet depth of water. So these are not small local floods. I mean, where I live in San Dimas, we had a flood that wiped out the road to the access to our home. We had to walk a mile and a half every day in and out to get to our home. But we're talking a few feet of water. We're not talking 330 feet, 400 feet of water. And that's in 99% of all the flood legends and stories of the ancient world. And 90% of them, the flood survivors are closely related to one another. So those that do survive the flood are all part of a single family, closely related, either one family or a family including uncles and aunts and cousins, but that's it. And in 80% of the stories, geographical place names are named. And so it's a place that people are familiar with. Survival by a floating vessel, a giant boat shows up in 75% of the stories. 75% mention a post-flood rainbow that had significance for the people that survived. 67%, the flood was blamed on pervasive human evil. Humanity was evil beyond description, and this is the reason for the flood. Two-thirds of all the stories. And that these people that were evil were warned of coming judgment. So in two-thirds of the stories, there's a prophet or a set of prophets that warns evil people that judgment is coming and they need to repent. And going on, 67%, two-thirds, animals are included in the judgment, and animals are included in the rescue. But it's only certain animals that are rescued, two-thirds of the stories. And divine judgment is the cause of the flood. So in half the stories, it's God who says we have to put an end to the wickedness of humanity. The vessel comes to rest on high ground. That's in half the stories. So the vessel just doesn't float around, but eventually it comes to rest on high ground. The source of the water, rainfall is mentioned in half of the stories as a source of the water. 40% mention underground aquifers. I mean, that's a rather obscure piece of information for ancient peoples, but it's in 40% of the stories. And in one-tenth of the stories, there are the human survivors offer sacrifices to this god. And Francis Schaeffer, in the 20th century, 1972, he wrote a book called Genesis in Space and Science. For those of you that are younger, Francis Schaeffer was one of the greatest apologists of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And he wrote this in his book, Genesis in Space and Time. He said, among the common myths in the world's history, no other one is so widespread as the story of the flood. Most of these myths have weird elements. In the Bible, these strange and foolish elements are not there. So he's contrasting. What's the difference? A lot of similarities as we've already mentioned, our table, but what are the differences? So that the Bible stands alone and that it does not contain impossible elements, things that are impossible to explain through science and history. But the non-biblical texts are filled with these, quote, weird elements that are impossible to explain by science and history. In the Bible, these strange and foolish elements are not there. The Bible gives us the history of the flood. The myths all over the world are contorted, but show that men everywhere have a memory of it. So no contortion or distortion of the flood story in the Bible, but we do see these distortions in the non-biblical flood stories. Here in the Bible is the one flood story whose details, including the construction of the vessel, are reasonable. That's something we're going to spend a Sunday looking at, is how when you look at the description of the vessel that rescued people, what you got in the Bible is scientifically and historically reasonable. What you have in the non-biblical accounts is neither historically or scientifically reasonable. The one that comes the closest is the Gilgamesh epic. It talks about a vessel that's about 200 feet across, 200 feet high. So it's basically 200 feet by 200 feet by 200 feet. Some think it might be cubical. Some think it might be kind of spherical. But if you ever try to float something like that, a model like that in your bathtub, you realize this is not stable to be in a lot of water and be able to retain sufficient stability that the people on board the ark are not killed or rendered incapable. So only in the flood account do you actually have a vessel that is seaworthy for an entire year, that be stable in water that would be flooding the region for a whole year. We don't see that in any other biblical account. Nevertheless, Francis Schaeffer is saying, we have these similarities, and there's so many similarities, so ubiquitous, it tells us we're not looking at multiple small floods affecting small portions of the population, human population, at different times. This really does testify to a single major flood that indeed wiped out all humans except for those on board the ark. The other interesting thing that Francis Schaeffer did, when he looked at these 400 stories, what he noted was this: the degree of distortion relative to what you see in the Bible is proportional to the distance away from the Middle East, and it's also proportional in the amount of time that's gone by relative to what we see in the Bible. So for example, when you get to the south tip of South America, we see there's way greater distortion than what you have, say, in the Babylonian and the Assyrian flood stories. The greater the distance, the greater the distortion, the greater separation in time, the greater the distortion. Now, a lot of debate then. Okay, we're talking about one flood that wiped out all of humanity except those on board the ark. Which flood are we talking about? Now, where you do have geographical place names, the geographical place names are all in the region of the Middle, the Near East, or Northeastern Africa. And so initially what we see, particularly in the 19th and early part of the 20th century, people, archaeologists were saying, hey, we're probably looking at a Mesopotamian flood. So they were speculating that all of humanity was living in the Mesopotamian plain or the Fertile Crescent, which might have gone all the way down to Egypt, and that would take care of northeastern Africa. And so they looked for evidence for a flood in that region. And they came up with a lot of data, flood deposits. But what they noticed is they could not find a single flood deposit that covered all of Mesopotamia. They did find those that covered 10,000 square miles, but they didn't find any that covered the entirety of the Mesopotamian plain. Multiple floods dated to different times, covering different regions. And so they said, this is difficult to square with all the similarities we see in the flood accounts, especially the great similarities we see in the accounts that are in the region of the Near and Middle East. And so that's where some skepticism was drawn, saying, we don't think it could be in the region of the Mesopotamian region. Yes, there are flood deposits. In fact, what's interesting is if you go try where you're close to the entrance of the Persian Gulf, the city of Ur or the city of Babylon, which is about halfway up in the Mesopotamian plain, you actually find evidence for multiple floods in the same location, but multiple floods that date to different times. And the biggest floods are those that date back into the last ice age. Those that are post-ice age, the floods only indeed cover a portion of the Mesopotamian plain, and again, different floods at different times. And so by the late part of the 20th century, there came the recognition Mesopotamia, before humans built dams, these floods were happening all the time. So floods in that region were quite frequent, just like floods, say, in the Mississippi Valley and in the San Joaquin Valley here in California were quite frequent before they built dams. The dams are basically there to prevent major floods from occurring. But before the era of dams, and by the way, the ancient Mesopotamians were building dams literally many thousands of years ago. So dam construction actually shows up quite early. But once you get back before humans were building dams or trying to control the flow of the meltwaters that were going on, you have multiple floods occurring over and over again. And not surprising, because after all, the Near East, you've got mountains, and the wintertime, those mountains get loaded up with snow and ice, and come the spring and the summer, that snow and ice melts. So you expect that there would be major flood events, just like you'd expect there'd be major flood events in the Mississippi and Missouri valleys and in the San Joaquin Valley, because the valleys there are fed by a lot of snow and ice melt that happens in the spring. Now, give me a minute here. I'm going to pull a book out of my briefcase. Okay, this book, titled Noah's Flood, The New Scientific Discoveries About the Event That Changed History, written by two geologists, William Ryan and Walter Pittman. This book was published about 20 years ago and got worldwide attention because people were saying, hey, finally we know what Noah's Flood is all about. And what they're really documenting is, hey, they start their book off by saying, Mesopotamia doesn't work. Nothing in the Fertile Crescent works. It's not the Nile River area, and it's not the area of the land of Israel. Actually, the flood is in a different location, and it's a much bigger flood than the floods that were uncovered by the British archaeologists in the 19th and 20th, early part of the 20th century. And what they were proposing is that the Black Sea had an inundation. And so they noted that if you go far enough back in time, say about 8,000 years ago, we have a land bridge that joins Greece to Anatolia, Anatolia being modern-day Turkey. And today, there's the Bosporus Strait, which allows Mediterranean seawater to connect with the Black Sea. But they point out that geologists have known for some time that if you go back far enough, actually there was no connection between the Mediterranean Sea and the Black Sea. There was a land bridge that joined Greece to Turkey. But what happened about 5,550 years ago is that this land bridge broke, and then you got a rush of Mediterranean seawater into the Black Sea. So this was their proposal, that if you go before 5,500 BC, the coastline for the Black Sea is basically that red outline that you see. And that's when you had the land bridge. The land bridge breaks. water rushes in from the Mediterranean Sea and basically more than doubles the size of the Black Sea. And they argue that there would have been spillover, which would have impacted, southern Russia, would have impacted the Danube River plain, and would have also impacted large regions in the near and Middle East. And so they claim this is Noah's flood. And the book sold very well, and it's gotten a lot of attention. But in the last 10 years, last 15 years, there's been a number of research papers basically throwing cold water on this Noah's flood hypothesis. Geologists and geophysicists and paleontologists have been weighing in saying, we don't think this can explain the biblical story. And what they point out is that William Ryan and Walter Pittman were basically claiming that we have a small Black Sea where the Black Sea level is about 90 meters less than what it is today, which means it's 300 feet lower. And so if you have Mediterranean seawater coming in and basically causing the sea level to go up by 300 feet, and if that all happens very quickly, then you could have devastation that it could impact a significant part of humanity. Now, Ryan and Pittman did admit in their book that this flood would not be sufficient to wipe out all of humanity except for those on a big boat. But they said it could wipe out enough of humanity that Noah and his family would think that all of humanity was wiped out. But what has happened since, and again, you can see that in about 150 years, we have the current coastline. So there was a change over 150 years. That's not disputed. What is disputed is that it really was about 150 years. It wasn't like 3 weeks where the sea level rose by 300 feet. And basically what modern day paleontologists and geologists are pointing out is that, number one, they went to the Danube Delta. The Danube flows through Romania and Bulgaria and into the Black Sea. I don't know whether you can see it there, but to the left, about up to where the upper part of that red line is, that's where the Danube River flows into the Black Sea. And they were able to do a study of the strata of the delta. And have you ever lived in a delta region? I grew up in Vancouver, British Columbia. The Fraser River flows out to the Pacific Ocean right by Vancouver. And you can actually see different layers of silt being laid down at different times as the river brings silt down. And so this is what they did. They looked at the buildup of silt strata at the Gulf of the Danube River. And they also looked at mollusk fossils. And with mollusk fossils, you get carbon-14 dating. And so they're able to actually see organic material in the strata. They saw the mollusk fossils. They were able to make dates. And what they were able to demonstrate was, we're not talking a flood of the magnitude that Ryan and Pittman claimed in this book on Noah's flood. It wasn't a rise of 300 feet of water. It was a rise of less than 98 feet of water, maximum of 98 feet. And moreover, they were saying, we're not looking at a doubling of the size of the Black Sea. We're actually looking at maybe a 30 to 40% increase in the Dead Sea area. So it's a much larger area, and we're not seeing 300 feet. We're seeing at most 98 feet. You say, well, that's the most, what's the least? They do admit that we're talking at least 40 feet of sea level rise, so something between 40 and 90 feet. And they're also saying this is not a huge sudden rush of water. This is water coming in from the Mediterranean through the Bosporus Strait, but it's coming in at a relatively slow area. And they calculate that the maximum rise of water in the area would be 1 foot per week, and probably just inches per week at most. Now, Right away, this makes it difficult to explain how such a flood could have wiped out, say, 70 to 80% of all human beings. I mean, if you notice the water at your coastline rising by a few inches per week, it's relatively straightforward to say, gee, we got to move to higher ground. You pack up all your belongings, get your children and animals together, you go to higher ground, and we're talking just inches per week. You got time to notice what's going on and prepare an escape. And so you wouldn't expect that there would be a very high death rate at all. In fact, with such a slow buildup of floodwaters, probably nobody would have been killed at all. Or maybe there's some accidents where people got killed, but there wouldn't be this widespread wiping out of humanity. And that's something we've noticed shows up in more than 90% of all the flood stories that are out there. And so today, this is no longer considered to be credible. And in the book I've just completed, I cite a review that was written in 2022, where the author went through all the research that was done to support this. And by the way, there are papers written around 2000, 2002 that support the claims in the book. But as he documents, there are way more refuting the claims than supporting the claims. And there's now no question, this is a fairly tepid flood. I would also argue that it occurs too late in human history. So not only is the flood too small, but it is too recent. We're talking just 5,500 BC, 7,500 years ago. And by that time, humanity has already spread out to all the regions of the world. Humans are now living in North and South America. Humans are living on Australia and New Guinea. And what you see in Genesis 10 and 11, and this is a major error that I pointed out 2 weeks ago. A lot of people think the account of the flood is limited to Genesis 6, 7, and 8. Actually, Genesis 9, 10, and 11 are hugely important because they talk about what happens after the flood. After the flood, God again rebukes humanity for their failure to multiply and fill the earth. And now we got God forcibly scattering humanity to occupy all the land masses of the earth. He also gave a command to Adam to multiply and fill the earth. And it's clear from Genesis 6, 9, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, humanity had failed to do that. So we got humanity in one locale. So it's possible to wipe out all humans and all the animals associated with them if we're talking a period of time before the great scattering of humanity. But the problem with the Black Sea flood inundation hypothesis is it happens after the great scattering humanity, not before the great scattering humanity. And I have a whole chapter in the book talking about the brand new scientific research that for the first time gives us reliable, indisputable dates for this great scattering of humanity. The dates come in at about 42 to 49,000 years ago. So that means that the flood of Noah would have to predate 42 to 49,000 years ago. And the date here of 7,500 years, it's way too recent. And this actually helps us appreciate why you get so many skeptical people saying, what we see in the Bible has to be scientific nonsense. It has to be scientific nonsense if you think that the flood happened just a few thousand years ago. Because a few thousand years ago, you'd expect abundant geological evidence for this flood, and that evidence simply is not there. But if you put the flood into the last ice age, during the last ice age, there were at least 40 major melt events where you have these glaciers thousands of feet thick melting rapidly all over the high latitudes and causing massive floods. Combine that with 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain, combine that with water coming up from the underground aquifers, you now got water of sufficient quantity happening sufficiently rapidly that indeed it could wipe out all of humanity. But in this case, what we see with the Danube Delta, it just doesn't work. I'll also talk next week about, we're talking during the last ice age. there are actually flood events during the last ice age that we can nail down. The ones we can nail down are the recent ones, like 12,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago. But we have enough data on those flood events to recognize that those flood events are definitely way bigger and more devastating and rapid than we see in the Black Sea hypothesis. But they still fall short of the necessary rapidity and extent to wipe out all of humanity at that time. And also, they're too recent. We're talking 11,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago. There's another major flood event 26,000 years ago. These are Ice Age flood events that are occurring after the great scattering humanity. And so we see in Genesis 10 and 11, humanity was rebelling against God, saying, we're going to build a city and a tower so we can remain as one people, one nation, and one region, and not be scattered over the face of the earth. So we see in Genesis 11 is an explicit, blatant rebellion against God's command to multiply and fill all the landmass regions of the earth. And so God, seeing what was going on, said, okay, they're going to do the same thing that the pre-flood peoples did. And if that happens, we're going to have to bring another flood. And he already promised Noah that wouldn't happen. And so he took action to prevent that kind of ubiquitous, reprobate, evil behavior from happening again. And I think I talked a little bit about this last week. What's going on in Genesis chapter 11, God recognizes if these humans set up one big capital city, one nation, one government, then that government will have a monopoly over the entire population of the world. And we all know what happens when a corporation gets a monopoly. Monopolies always result in the product becoming of lower quality and higher price for the customers. Likewise, God is recognizing if we have one nation ruled by one government over all the peoples of the world, that government will oppress its citizens. And therefore, to prevent this happening, what we see in Genesis 11, God scattered humanity over all the land masses of the world and gave them different languages and different nations. You also see the explicit statement in Genesis 11 that God had already designed the land masses in such a way that there would be natural boundaries, mountains and rivers and seas and lakes, which would allow a smaller, weaker nation to protect itself against the attempts of a stronger, more powerful, more populous nation to dominate them. Therefore, multiple nations with multiple languages, so that if one nation oppresses its citizens, those citizens can say, you know what, it's going to be tough to learn a different language, but hey, I get to be out of this oppressive environment. I'm going to leave and move to that nation. And if you go back 100, 200, 300 years ago, that was the United States of America. Oppressed peoples from all the nations of the world where the government was oppressing its citizens, what happened? Those people got up and left and came here to America, where they realized there wouldn't be the oppression. Or at least where they could escape the government oppression by moving to a part of the United States where people hadn't yet colonized, and they were able to establish something there. It's one reason why the founding fathers of the United States, I think, were wise. They were saying, we're not going to have a single government over the whole of the people. We're going to set up a federal system, multiple states. So if one state begins to oppress its citizens, the citizens of those states can get up and leave and go to a different state. And actually today we're seeing that happening. We happen to live, in fact, tomorrow I'm flying to Texas. I'm going to be speaking in Texas tomorrow and all the way through to Thursday. And whenever I'm in Texas, I tell people here, you know, I'm not from Texas. I'm from the state of taxes. That always gets a big laugh. But I think we're all aware that there are people here in California that feel oppressed by the heavy taxes here. So what do? They get up and move, and they go to a state where the taxes are less. Or they want an education system. I mean, I was born in Canada, in Quebec. And when I was born, the education system in Quebec was totally sectarian. And so I was 4 years of age, but my parents were concerned. Hey, when our three children get to be of school age, we're going to have to put them in a Protestant school, a Catholic school, or a Jewish school. And at that time, my parents were Christians, and they didn't want us being kind of brainwashed into a particular religion. They're also aware that the academic quality of education at that time in Quebec wasn't that great. And so they basically took our entire family and moved us out to British Columbia, which at that time had the best, the schools were public, they weren't sectarian, and they also had the highest academic quality of any of the provinces. And so they were able to move from one province to another province. Well, likewise, we have to recognize we need to look for a flood that predates the antitrust legislation we see in Genesis 11, that predates the time when God set up multiple nations where the governments of those nations had to compete with one another for worthy citizens. And so this indeed is too recent. And so we have to be looking at a flood event previous to 26,000 years ago. And given the fact that we now have reliable, consistent dates for when humans left the Near and Middle East and Eastern Africa and basically began to inhabit and colonize all of Europe, Northern Europe and Southern Europe, amazingly, was colonized at exactly the same time. Likewise, all of Asia, all of Africa, that all happened, all of Australia, that all happened 42 to 49,000 years ago. And what's interesting is once you get previous to that, we have multiple major melt events during the last ice age that combine with torrential rain and combined with underground aquifers indeed could wipe out all of humanity if we have all of humanity living in one geographical region. Okay, I'll stop there and we'll pick up next week where we're actually going to be addressing the claim that's been made by many theologians where they say nobody in the Christian community, least those that were writing Christian scholarly pieces, believed in a flood that didn't encompass the entire globe until past the year 1800. And we're actually going to actually look at what the early church fathers wrote, and what we see is that none of them endorsed a global flood until the Reformation, and this was the emergence of geology in Britain, not until about 1700 did anyone actually endorse a global flood interpretation. So it's simply a myth that the church believed in a global flood until we get up to the time of Charles Darwin. Now, as usual, we take questions. Here in Paradoxes, we always allow as much time for questions as we do for the teaching, discussion, debate, issues you want to bring up. And we're going to alternate between people here in person and people that are participating with us virtually at paradoxes.org. And by the way, you'll notice there's cameras here. Every class here in Paradoxes does get video recorded, and it's all archived at paradoxes.org. So if you want to figure out what was covering here, 5-6 weeks ago, you can go there and you can download the MP3s for free. And that's really where we get the greatest participation in the Paradoxes class. I mean, we got, maybe 30 or 40 of you here in person. We get 50 or so participating virtually, but there's thousands of people that download the recording from this class literally all over the world. Okay, we have a question from the virtual audience.
Yeah. Yes, we do. It's a very good question. It's one I have never heard before, which is a first for me. In the Bible, both in Genesis 8, Leviticus 1, and 2 Corinthians 2:15, the Bible talks about burnt offerings being a pleasing aroma to the Lord. Could you tell us the meaning about that and what that's all about?
Yeah, good question, because we actually see that in Genesis chapter 9, when Noah and his family get off the ark and start to rebuild civilization, one of the first things they do is they sacrifice some of the clean animals that God said, hey, take 7 pairs of these. And so they sacrifice a few of those, and how God looked at what they did and says it was a pleasing aroma to him. Now, God does not have a body. God the Father, God the Holy Spirit, they're spirit beings. It is true that the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ, has the fullness of the deity in bodily form. But when the Bible talks about God the Father having wings to gather his people under his wings, or having legs or having eyes, and in this case, having a nose that's able to smell this, we need to realize these are figures of speech, basically saying that what God was seeing taking place by Noah offering these animals, it was akin to someone smelling the cooking meat and how I'm taking pleasure from that. Basically what those texts are saying, both in Chronicles and here in Genesis chapter 9, is that when God saw these people making sacrifice to him, particularly when they got the significance of the sacrifices, that these were not sacrifices that delivered them from sin, rather these were sacrifices that symbolize the sacrifice that God himself would give to deliver us from sin. When God saw these sacrifices being conducted and saw that the people understood the symbolism behind these sacrifices, this brought pleasure to him. It'd be akin to someone at a barbecue smelling some delicious steak being barbecued and enjoying the smell and thinking forward, boy, this is really going to taste good. So again, the eyes of the Lord wander to and fro the earth. He doesn't really have eyes, but he's able to, quote, recognize everything that's going on. Likewise, he's able to recognize that these people not only were obeying him, but understood the significance of what they were doing. Again, if you go to Hebrews, it tells us that the blood of bulls and goats has no benefit whatsoever to deliver us from the consequences of our sin, but it symbolizes the blood that would deliver us. And ancient people, some of them, got that point. Noah got that point. Job got that point. David got that point. A lot of them missed the point. But when people got the symbolic significance of what they're doing, this brought pleasure to God. Okay, next question.
All right, so I have like four questions, but I'll start with one of them. So correct me if I'm wrong. So you mentioned in Genesis, there's a cooling event in the earth, correct? So recently, as of 2 months ago, there was a scientific paper released suggesting that around 500 million years ago, an asteroid about the size of Phobos, or the one that destroyed the dinosaurs, was turned into a ring system. What's your response to that?
Yes, that was 66 million years ago. Where an asteroid struck the Earth and brought about an extinction event. All the dinosaurs were wiped out. 75% of all species of life were wiped out. It also had a climatic effect. And we're talking an asteroid that's about 6 miles in diameter. And there was a major debate. Was it the asteroid that brought about the extinction event, or was it volcanoes erupting all over the world? Because we saw them both dated to the same time. There's now a recognition that an asteroid of that size will puncture the crust of the Earth, and that puncturing ignites volcanic eruptions all over the world. So it's not either or, it's both and. Now what I find interesting is that you see multiple extinction events like this. These extinction events actually play a role in changing the atmospheric composition. And so we basically see is that less and less carbon dioxide remains in the atmosphere. That's a good thing because the sun is getting progressively brighter and brighter. So as the sun gets brighter and brighter, our atmosphere, because greenhouse gases are being drawn out from it, becomes progressively weaker and weaker in its capacity to trap heat from the sun. And what we see is that the degree of removal of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere perfectly compensates for the increasing brightening of the sun. And yes, the sun will be brighter next year than it has been this year, but by a very, very, very tiny amount. It's taken the sun 3.8 billion years to get about 23% brighter than it was 3.8 billion years ago. So it's a very gradual brightening of the sun. But it's such that 3 million years from now, human life will not be possible on planet Earth, because in order to compensate for the brightening of the sun 3 million years from now, we'll have to pull so much greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere that photosynthesis will no longer be possible. And you're not going to be able to sustain human civilization without photosynthetic production going on in the plants. This is actually mentioned, or at least alluded to, in Psalm 104, verses 29 and 30, where the psalmist talks about how it's the property of all life to die off. But when life dies off, God recreates and renews the face of the earth. And so we see these mass extinction events followed by mass speciation events. Huge challenge to the naturalistic explanation for the history of life on planet Earth. Because every time you have a mass extinction event, it's quickly followed by a mass speciation event. Millions of new species suddenly appear on the planet to replace the millions that were driven to extinction. But here's what's especially amazing. The new species are more efficient at pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere than the previous species. So here we got the sun getting brighter and brighter and brighter. We got God removing life from planet Earth, replacing with new life, where that new life is more efficient at drawing out greenhouse gases from the atmosphere and drawing them out at exactly the level it's necessary to perfectly compensate for the brightening of the sun. The other thing I find interesting is that if you want to be able to continually compensate for the brightening of the sun, you're going to need a mass extinction event followed by a mass speciation event occurring about once every 30 to 35 million years. What do we see in the fossil record? It happens about once every 30 to 35 million years. And actually, we can understand how that happens, because every 30 to 35 million years, our solar system passes through the plane of our galaxy. When you pass through the plane of the galaxy, our solar system gets gravitationally disturbed by giant molecular clouds. What do those disturbances do? It causes comets and asteroids to come towards the Earth. And so there's a reason why most of these mass extinction events we see are a direct result of big comets and or asteroids striking the Earth. So hopefully that helps. I'll take your follow-up questions next time you come to the microphone. Go ahead.
Next question is a church history question. If you're just for everybody familiar with history, obviously, the Catholic Church broke in two. We had the Byzantine Church, which became the Orthodox Church. We have the Roman Catholic Church in Rome. And the question relating to this church history question is, the Roman Catholic Church for a long time claimed to be the only true church. Do they still do that, and what's the history of that?
Okay, well, it's not just the Roman Catholic Church that claims to be the only true church. The Eastern Orthodox also claim to be the only true church, so they're both making the same claim. The Protestants, they say, hey, we split away so recently, we're not going to make that claim. But they do claim, what I see in Protestants saying, we have a doctrine that's closer to the Bible than what you see in either Roman Catholicism or Eastern Orthodox. Now, one of my colleagues at Reasons to Believe, Kenneth Samples, he worked for Walter Martin and the Christian Research Institute, and one of his jobs was actually to research Roman Catholicism and the Eastern Orthodox Church to see if they actually fall outside of what the Bible tells us defines who Christians are. And he says, hey, they have different beliefs than we Protestants, but the beliefs are not so radically different that they're outside of the Christian community. So Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholics, and Protestants all fit in within the realm of what the Bible defines as Christianity. But I really appreciated what Ken Samples added to that. He says, within all three branches of the Christian church, you'll find sects within those branches where they do depart from what the Bible would identify as being true followers of Jesus Christ. And so it's not just the Roman Catholics that have these branches that are aberrant. says you also find them in the Eastern Orthodox Church, and you also find them in the Protestant Church. And we're warned in Scripture that this would happen. And so regardless of what branch of the church you're in, we need to be diligent to make sure we really are. And part of what causes people to think that the Eastern Orthodox are not true followers of Jesus Christ is that they don't have the same wording on the doctrine of original sin that you see within the Protestant community. However, I think it's a matter of semantics. This is something I wrote about in Rescue Inerrancy. What you see in the Eastern Orthodox Church is that they deny that all people got sin from Adam, but they also agree that everybody from Adam forwards are sinners. And so one sense is, I would argue, it's kind of a semantical distinction. They do agree on what's key, that all human beings are sinners before God and in need of redemption from the Creator of the universe. It really defines who's a Christian, who's not a Christian. Okay, your follow-up question.
So this one's more related to, I guess, what was presented. Why didn't God use fire to destroy the world? The reason why I mentioned that specifically is, specifically in Peter and Revelation, there's mentions of scorching the earth, and there's an interesting parallel there with water being used in the Old Testament and I guess a sort of metaphorical second flood being used with fire.
I think I got the question. And you'll do see a passage in 2 Peter 3 where it talks about how God brought water to destroy the earth and wicked humanity at the time of Noah. The next time, he's going to bring fire. But we need to look at that in the context of the passages in the book of Isaiah that address the same phenomena. And basically, you see in 2 Peter is that there will come a time when God will bring about not just the end of humanity, but the end of the entire universe. All the stars, galaxies, the solar system, everything is going to be removed. And what God is going to do is he's going to wrap up the entire universe and says he's going to wrap it up like a scroll. So it's going to be squeezed up like a scroll and it's going to end in a fiery heat. So it's basically saying the end of the universe, we're going to have this vast universe compressed into a tiny volume and it's going to be very hot. Well, this kind of fits with what you see in Big Bang cosmology. In Big Bang cosmology, and by the way, the Bible predicted four of the fundamental features of Big Bang cosmology thousands of years before astronomers discovered it. Namely, that the universe has a beginning that includes a beginning of space and time, that the universe is subject to laws of physics that have never changed. We're told that one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay, and that would imply that the universe is getting colder and older, colder and colder as it continues to expand. 11 passages of the Bible speak about how God continually expands the universe. So, and you'll find an article I've written at reasons.org on what the Bible says and doesn't say about Big Bang cosmology. It doesn't describe everything, but it actually predicted four fundamental features of the Big Bang before any astronomers discovered them. But in Big Bang cosmology, you got the universe starting off as an infinitesimal volume that's nearly infinitely hot. But that infinitesimal volume is designed by God to expand. As it expands under the laws of thermodynamics, it gets cooler and cooler and cooler. Same principle as your car engine. When the piston chamber expands, the gasoline or the diesel fuel stops burning because the temperature goes below the combustion point. And so the universe is beginning cooler and cooler. What you see in 2 Peter 3 and in two passages in the book of Isaiah, there'll come a time when that's reversed, when the universe will be compressed and no longer will it be cold, it'll become very hot. And a lot of astronomers have said, wow, maybe that fits in to the oscillating universe model or it fits in to the ekpyrotic Big Bang model. There's a lot of ways. You only got three passages. There's a lot of ways physicists can look at those passages and say, hey, something akin to this is going to happen. Frankly, I think many of them speculate way beyond what the text actually states. but it does state explicitly the universe we're living in today is temporary. It will end and will be no more. So don't get too attached to the universe. It's not going to last forever. And God's going to replace it with a brand new creation. In that creation, the physics will be different. The dimensions will be different. In fact, I just finished writing an article. I'm going to send it to the magazine that's going to publish it this afternoon, basically making the point that we need the laws of physics and the space-time dimensions to be tools in God's hands to rapidly eradicate all evil and suffering. But the moment evil is no longer a factor in God's creation, there will no longer be a need for length, width, height, and time, or thermodynamics, or gravity, or electromagnetism, or the strong and weak nuclear forces. Those won't be necessary anymore. God's going to replace them with new physics and new dimensions. That'll be the new creation, and no longer will we have to worry about thermodynamics causing our bodies to decay, or gravity causing increasing damage to our bodies. I mean, all of us have seen the effects of the laws of physics on our human bodies. And if you don't believe me, look at one another. It's real. It's happening. And for those of you young, just wait. It'll catch up with you too. So, but a time will come when our bodies will never decay because we'll be living under different laws of physics. But that won't happen until evil is eradicated. The moment that evil is eradicated, the universe will no longer have a purpose. God's going to replace it with a brand new realm. I think you've got two more, but we'll catch up with another one. Go ahead.
I've got two questions for you that I'm not going to ask you to answer, though. I'm going to go ahead and answer them because you've already answered it today, and the other one you answered just 2 weeks ago. The first one, obviously, is coming from the young Earth perspective. They're like, were the pyramids built before or after the flood? We've already answered that question. The flood was during the last ice age. The pyramids, if nobody's familiar with, are approximately 3,000 BC, plus or minus a couple hundred years. So the pyramids were built way after the flood. The second one I personally asked you 2 weeks ago, are there any human fossils? And the answer is no. It takes a long time for a bone to turn into a stone, which is why we have fossils of dinosaurs. It took a long, long time to turn into stone. And when humans, we only find bones. We don't find any fossils. That was a question I asked 2 weeks ago that you explained in detail. So we're going to move on to the next question.
A comment and a question. First, I'm shocked to hear that there won't be photosynthesis in 3 million years, so I better get cracking on my garden. But my question is about, you commented that before the Reformation, nobody believed that the flood was global. So can you cite some particular theologians that proposed that view?
Yeah. Theologians began to propose a view of a global flood, basically in reaction to the Darwinian model for the origin and history of life. And they saw this as a way to strike back at that. So it's a relatively recent phenomena of people believing in a global flood. The first person to explicitly talk about a global flood was an English author at the end of the 1600s. I'll be addressing that next week, what he had to say. But even back in the 1700s and 1800s, it was rare for a Christian to claim that the Bible taught a global flood. But that's the first time you see anyone explicitly endorsing a global flood. So my whole point is that it's a myth that people previous to 1800 or the 18th century all believed in a global flood. Now, here's what causes people to think they did. A lot of them wrote about a worldwide flood. None of them wrote about a global flood, but they did write about a worldwide flood. But it's interesting, when you look at worldwide events throughout all of Scripture, none of them are global. So one of the things we're going to do is actually go through. Let's look at all the biblical texts that talk about a worldwide event. We discover it's the world of humanity at that time. It's not referring to the entire surface of planet Earth. We even see this in the New Testament. If you look at the first chapter of Romans, what does God say of the Roman Christians? Your faith has been heard throughout the whole world. Now, I doubt if the Incas in Peru had heard about the faith of the first century Romans, but everybody in the Roman Empire had heard about it. So when he meant the whole world, he meant the Roman world. And likewise, we see with the flood, when you go to 2 Peter chapter 3, God contrasts the world of Noah with the world of Rome, and basically makes the point that the flood of Noah, the world of Noah, was different than the world of Rome. And so, and likewise, we see that we have Joseph feeding all the nations of the whole world. But if you read on a few verses in the text, it says he fed people from as far away as Arabia and the southern reaches of the Egyptian Empire. And so the kind of, he actually defines what he meant by the world. It's the whole of the world of the Egyptian world. And hey, only in the 20th and 21st century have we considered worldwide to be identical to global. It's because now we're all global citizens. But that was not true of your great-great-great-grandfathers. Okay, next question.
All right, so this is about your appearance on Daily Dose of Wisdom. So in this interview, you mentioned you didn't believe in the existence of aliens. So I guess the question I wanted to ask you is, do you believe there are possibly demons? The reason why I say that is because I saw some drawings from Aleister Crowley, and they looked identically to what demon depictions are, or alien depictions. And if so, do you believe that something like Project Bluebeam, the conspiracy theory, where the U.S., where the government will fake the U.S., will fake like some kind of invasion from space?
Interesting is that our U.S. government is now saying that they're going to be transparent about the UFO phenomena. But notice they no longer call them UFOs, unidentified flying objects. The term they're using is unexplained aerial phenomena. And they are admitting that there's something in going on that is real, but it can't be explained. Very similar to what you see in the books by Jacques Vallée, the French astrophysicist who's devoted his life to studying the UFO phenomena. He says the vast majority of what people report as UFOs are either natural phenomena, their military activity that they're being tried to keep secret, or it's a hoax, or it's some kind of instrumental defect. For example, I've actually got a collection of photographs I've taken of UFOs where all of them are simply lens defects. So you can get some really interesting things happening if you've got a camera with six lenses in it. So you get these optical effects. If you want to have your own collection of UFO photos, that's one easy way to do it. Find a camera with multiple reflections or lenses, and you should be able to get some interesting effects there. So, but he says there's a residual. He says this residual is real, but can't be explained. And actually, Jacques Vallée says, it can't be explained by anything we understand about the physics of the universe. And he concludes we're dealing with interdimensional entities. We're dealing with entities outside of the physics of this universe, outside the universe. And there's a lot of speculation. Well, what are these interdimensional entities? Well, the Bible refers to angels as being interdimensional entities. And so this is what's led to the speculation. Maybe what people report as these unexplained aerial phenomena is actual activity or appearances by angels, and since this phenomena seems to be harmful and not beneficial, it must be the fallen angels. So that's the basis of that particular claim. And we've written a book on this called Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, where we document that in terms of the residual UFOs that prove to be real and not physical, it only happens to people who are involved in the occult. And we're warned in the Bible is that involvement in the occult gives permission to the fallen angels, to the demons, to invade your life. And we point out in our book is if you get the occult out of your life, that'll be the end of your UFO encounters. It's a testable hypothesis. Start playing with the occult, don't be surprised if weird things happen. Get involved, get the occult out of your life, that'll be the end of it. But it's not just getting the alcohol out of your life. You need to also ensure that close family members are not involved in the alcohol, because these fallen angels, again, explicit in the Bible, they can use a close relative to get to another individual. They can also use a sexual partner. I remember speaking to a young man who was having multiple UFO encounters, and he said, "There's no alcohol in my life at all." I said, "Well, what about any of your relatives?" "No, none of my relatives are involved in the alcohol." "You must be wrong about your explanation." And I said, "Are you in a sexual relationship?" He says, "Well, yes, I am." And I said, well, who are you?" He says, my sexual partner is a witch. And I said, "Well, I think that's your connection." So once he broke off that relationship, that was the end of his UFO encounters. So, and incidentally, UFO encounters most frequently happen at 3 a.m. in the morning on lonely country roads. That's where you get the greatest incidents of people reporting the residual UFOs that prove to be real but not physical. Well, who hangs out on lonely country roads at 3 a.m. in the morning? That's where all of these big telescopes are. They're on lonely country roads. They don't want to be near city lights. And astronomers are hanging around there at 3 a.m. in the morning. What's interesting about that, astronomers have one of the lowest incidences of encounters with UFOs. So if this wasn't connected with the occult, you'd expect them to have a high rate of encounter. It's actually extremely low. I do know personally of two astronomers who are frequently having UFO encounters. Both of them were heavy into the occult, and they were only logging 3 or 4 hours on the telescope a year. So, and then those of us who are logging thousands of hours, we never had an encounter. So I think the case is very strong that indeed it is these fallen angels. And the Bible does tell us he created two distinct species of intelligent life, one constrained by the physics of the universe and one that's not constrained. Okay, next question.
I can't remember the name of the person, but there's somebody who's claiming that the Earth had rings as recent as 500 million years ago. Have you heard of that theory, and is there any credibility to it?
Actually, the Earth has a ring right now. All big planets have rings. So we see a ring around Neptune, we see one around Uranus, we see one around Saturn, we see one around Jupiter, multiple rings. Of course, Saturn's the most spectacular, but even our planet Earth has a ring, but it's extremely tiny. And it's easy to understand why. If you have a big gravitational well, it's going to attract tiny comets and asteroids. So, for example, those spectacular rings of Saturn, it's made up basically of snowflakes. 80% of the rings of Saturn are basically snowflakes, dirty snowflakes. They got some other compounds associated with them. So they're tiny objects, but they're just literally quadrillions of them making this ring. Likewise, Earth has a sufficiently strong gravity. It's inevitable it's going to attract some of these tiny comets and asteroids to orbit around with them. But because Earth's gravity is so much weaker than that of the gas giant planets, the rings do get disturbed. So Earth has rings that form and get destroyed and reform and get destroyed over and over again. But Earth has never had a big ring. The rings have always been tiny. We're generating a ring around planet Earth that's way bigger than the natural rings. And those are the tens of thousands of satellites we have orbiting our planet. And as they begin to wear out and bump into one another, it's going to form a ring. Matter of fact, I can share this with you as an astronomer. The Hubble Space Telescope is getting more and more degraded as time goes by. Not because the telescope is wearing out so much, but because there's literally hundreds of thousands of satellites orbiting around the region where the Hubble Space Telescope is. And those spectacular images you see published by the Hubble Space Telescope, they're all corrected before they show them to you. What we do is we take out all the satellite tracks that cross. But a typical Hubble Space Telescope image where they do an hour's exposure will have 20 or 30 satellite tracks going through it. And these are quite bright, And so they use computers to remove the streaks of light, but consequently, the background image does get degraded. And so as time goes by, the quality of the Hubble Space Telescopes becomes less and less because of this ring of thousands of satellites that orbit our planet. And that's one of the advantages of the James Webb Space Telescope. They've put it so far away that it's way beyond any satellite that would cause a problem. The most distantly orbiting satellites are the GPS satellites. They're 22,000 miles away, but the James Webb is a million miles away. So none of its images get spoiled by satellite tracks.
I want to go back to your talk about the destruction of the dinosaurs. I have a granddaughter who was in kindergarten last year and came home one day and said, I learned that when all the dinosaurs were destroyed, the littlest ones survived, and that's where we got birds. And I'm not conversant in evolutionary theory, and I was speechless at the thought of this being taught in kindergarten. But my daughter, who is a doctorate in physical chemistry, not biochem, agreed with her. And that was even more shocking. So what is the basis for this idea?
Basis for the claim that tiny dinosaurs somehow survived the mass extinction event 66 million years ago, and they evolved into modern-day birds, is because they've actually found dinosaurs that have feathers on them. So birds are not the only animals that have feathers. And you got dinosaurs with two legs, just like you got birds with two legs. But that's kind of where it stops, because this mass extinction event of 66 million years ago was of such a devastating nature, the small dinosaurs did not survive. So this idea that birds evolved from small dinosaurs that survived the extinction event, that event basically wiped out all big animal life. Some speculate that some of the marine life might have survived, but others say no. All the animal life in the oceans that were more than just microbial in size also got wiped out. We're talking 75% of all species. And the earliest fossil we have for birds does date back to 140 million years. So you do have birds before the mass extinction event of the dinosaurs. So the idea that the survivors evolved into birds, wait a minute, we had birds before that event. So birds have been around for 140 million years, and their anatomy is radically different than that of the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs were kind of moving around on the ground, and they had heavy bones, just like we humans have heavy bones. The birds have these hollow bones. After all, they got to be able to fly. I mean, they need to have a light body weight. They also have to be warm-blooded because they got to expend a lot of energy in a short period of time. All the evidence we have tells us that dinosaurs were cold-blooded. So the internal organs, the body structure, the way they breathe, all radically different from the dinosaurs. So that's something the teacher probably was not aware of, is yes, there are some similarities, but the differences are way greater than the similarities. And the extinction event was not tepid. It was a mass extinction event. It's considered to be the second or third biggest mass extinction event that ever happened. So there would be no survivors of the dinosaurs.
Just a quick update. Obviously, Hugh, your numbers are a little bit different from mine. I'm a band a believer, and there's a number of scientists that are called bands. Birds are not dinosaurs. And that's because I and lots of other scientists disagree that there are no feathered dinosaurs. I looked at every single quote-unquote feathered dinosaur, and I couldn't find any evidence of any feather. A lot of dinosaurs have is frills on their back, like we see on the iguanas, and they're claiming that those are feathers. Other times they find a little pot mark on a dinosaur skeleton, and they claim that that was the point where a feather was attached, when in reality it's just like a dot, it could be anything. Probably a good 25% of scientists object to this feathered dinosaur theory. And the second thing is there is a date of 210 million years ago for the first modern bird that's disputed, but I looked at the evidence and I don't dispute it. Birds' feet are very unique in having three toes forward and one back, and we have a footprint of a modern bird 210 million years ago. Again, that's debated, but again, a lot of the band scientists like myself would say that birds are that. And my prediction is that birds will be put back even further showing up at the same time as dinosaurs. Next question.
That's a good point. The earliest undisputed evidence is they've been around at least 140, but some say earlier. I mean, you got enough oxygen for birds to be able to fly around for at least the past 200 million years. And yes, thank you, Dave, because the word feather is very broadly defined by people who claim that dinosaurs were feathered creatures. They're not talking feathers like the birds have feathers today. And as an astronomer, we talk about our galaxy having feathers. So the word feather can have a different definition depending what scientific discipline you're in. Okay, Nancy.
Good morning, Hugh. As I was driving to class today, I was listening to a Catholic radio station that I often listen to that has some pretty good research on some things, I think. And the commentary was talking about the Catholic Church and supposed sites of UFO crashes with three-fingered bodies, bodies with different DNA, etc. Now, this commentator said he's not certain if this could be physical or if it could be demonic, as you talk about. But I was curious about the broader perspective of the Catholic Church. He was also talking about a book, The Catholic Church and UFOs, because this is talked about so much. You probably talked about this before, but could you refresh me on this? Repetition aids learning for me. Thank you.
Very good. And just like there's a broad spectrum of Protestants' views on UFOs, there's a broad spectrum of Roman Catholics. In fact, just a few weeks ago, I did a podcast with a Roman Catholic scholar who's written a book on UFOs. And his view on UFOs is fairly similar to the one that I've written, but the one you're talking about is quite different. So just realize it's not a monolith amongst Roman Catholics. They have a broad range of interpretations. But the Roman Catholic scholar I was engaging, he agreed with me that there is no physical evidence that we can put in a museum that says, hey, this is the remnants of a UFO body or the remnants of a UFO craft. Evidently, what you were listening to, he was actually claiming that we have such evidence. It was just a few weeks ago that the U.S. Congress had their second study on, what about these claims that people are making about our government actually covering up physical evidence of UFOs. So David Grush was testifying about a half a year ago, and then they had some other individuals testifying a few weeks ago. What I found interesting in those testimonies, by the way, I got to talk to somebody who was part of that first congressional investigation, and he assured me not a single congressman or congresswoman gave any credence to the claims that David Grush was making. They were all quite disturbed that David Grush had changed his story. He was claiming that the U.S. government actually had in a warehouse the remains of several UFO bodies. And when he testified before Congress, he said, well, what we have is biologic tissue. And the congressmen were astute. They said, can you define for us what you mean by biologic material? He says, yeah, I didn't mean tissue, I meant biologic material. Tell us, what do you mean by this biologic material? And he wouldn't say. And then he said, well, do you mean we have DNA? He wouldn't say. He completely backed away from his previous claims, which of course got them suspicious. Maybe there's no truth to any of his claims. Likewise, he claimed that we had metallic objects and objects from UFO craft that are unlike any of the materials we have today. And the Congress people were saying, well, could they at least identify the elements in the periodic table that these things were composed of? Again, he ducked the question. It's like, well, we're pretty certain there's only, you know, 98 natural elements, and you can't even identify, and you're suggesting maybe it's an element we've never heard of. How is this going to work? So, and then what really got them suspicious, he said, the U.S. government's been covering this up since 1932. And the Congress people, they were well aware, wait a minute, 1932, we all know how our government works. They're not able to cover up something of that magnitude, literally, for 90 years. And so they said, we dismiss all the claims. Same thing happened a few weeks ago. And by the way, this is now becoming worldwide. Even France is now saying we need to be transparent about these UFOs. So what's happening here in the U.S. is actually happening worldwide, where the governments are basically releasing their stuff. And the official position of the U.S. government today is it's real, but it's something unexplainable. And since it's unexplainable, we see no reason to really spend a lot of money on it. Similar to what happened to NASA, when I'm dating myself here, where we have, what's the president before Gerald Ford? The guy who's now 100 years old? Yeah, Carter. When he made a campaign promise, you elect me as president, I'll get to the bottom of this UFO phenomena. I will force NASA to investigate it. He got elected president, and Jimmy Carter went to NASA, and NASA basically said, give us something physical we can study, and we'll study it. If you can't give us anything physical, that's not our mandate. We only study stuff that's physical. And Jimmy Carter couldn't come up with anything that's physical. So it's like, if our government really had something in a warehouse, surely Jimmy Carter would have told NASA, go to warehouse 1357 in New Mexico, you'll find the physical stuff. He was not able to do that. And so, by the way, NASA still stands by that. We'll only investigate stuff that we know is real and physical. And since the government has made it clear, we're dealing with something that's real, but it's not unexplained. Can't be explained. That's why they're calling it unexplained aerial phenomena. It's beyond what we can possibly explain. And it's beyond what we can possibly explain. That's not a job for the scientists. Okay. This is number four, right?
Yeah, I have one more question, but maybe I might ask you more personally. But why does God allow mass extinctions like the Great Dying during the Permian period or the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs?
Yeah, good question. Why would a good, all-powerful God allow these mass extinctions to happen, especially the Permian Triassic, where 95% of all species of life are wiped out? Nothing less than that would compensate for the brightening of the sun. God's intent was to sustain life on planet Earth continually for 3.8 billion years. The only way that can be done is through repeated mass extinction and mass speciation events. Also, with the Permian Triassic catastrophe, there was major chemical changes going on in the atmosphere and the soil of the Earth. And it was those changes that made possible the introduction of much more advanced species of life. So that's another part of God's plan. He starts off with microbial life 3.8 billion years ago, but his plan was to gradually increase the complexity and the size of life forms, paving the way for human beings. He actually brings us human beings upon the terrestrial scene as quickly as possible, but a lot of preparation was necessary to prepare the planet and the life on the planet for the entry of we human beings, where we humans could build and launch and sustain civilization. So now I address explicitly the Triassic, the Permian Triassic catastrophe and how it paved the way for human civilization in my book, Improbable Planet. So the details are there. But yes, there's a reason why they have to be as catastrophic as they are. But also, when you look at the catastrophe, realize how quickly, within just a few million years, we have millions of brand new species that replace the ones that were before. The new species are more complex and more advanced, and they draw down the greenhouse gases by exactly the degree we need. They also begin to do the chemical transformations that are crucial for us humans to be able to live here on planet Earth.
I want to go back to anthropomorphisms for just a minute. We were talking about the aroma being a sweet smelling. And I don't have a problem with all those except for the one where it says that God looked and saw that the earth was, totally wicked. And that happens in other places where it makes it sound like God just woke up and he wasn't noticing before. And the only way I can explain that is that we're not understanding that he's outside time and he's known all the time and it's simply a matter of his timing. But do you have any better explanation for that?
Yeah, good question. And a lot of theologians have tried to dig into that. And the thing I notice is that in the days before the flood, you have humans with the possibility of living past 900 years. And maybe one reason why God waited as long as he did to take action, to bring a halt to the spread of evil was going on, was to ensure that all humans would learn the lesson. Given the physics of this universe, given our propensity for sin and evil, it's really good we don't live very long. We live more than 80 or 90 years on average, we're in deep trouble. Evil runs out of control with long lifespans. But we all have this belief that living a long time would be really good. And so maybe what's going on the days before the flood is an object lesson. One reason why I kind of like that interpretation is we see God performing other object lessons at different times, evidently one in the future. And so we have seen passages in Isaiah and in Revelation where Jesus will come back here to planet Earth. He will rule as king over the whole planet. And once again, people will be able to live longer than 80 or 90 years. And what he's going to do is set up a perfect government. It's going to be perfectly righteous. We're going to have redeemed humans who have been perfected in terms of their character coming back with Jesus. And so one way of looking at this thousand-year period, it's a period when God removes all the human excuses for why we sin. You know, I had a bad family upbringing. I grew up in a nation where the government was very oppressive. And, and then people were basically killing. What happens during the millennium? God's going to get rid of animals killing one another, or we humans eating meat. We're all going to be a vegetarian, or maybe we're all going to be eating lab meat. Something my colleague has written on is a time will come, probably, in fact, you can actually buy now, if you're rich enough, you can buy meat that does not come from an animal. It's actually grown in the lab on a petri dish. Right now, it's quite expensive, but the potential is there to bring about lab meat that's cheaper than any meat you can buy in a supermarket. So, during the millennium, maybe we're going to have the technology where all that's possible. But notice what it talks to us about what happens at the end of the millennium. By the way, a lot of people said, Satan made me do it. The demons made me do it. They tempted me. They deceived me. What does God do during the millennium? He locks them all up. What does he do at the end of the millennium? He releases Satan to go throughout the world and test and tempt all the children born during the millennium. And what does it tell us? The majority of those children who had all the advantages choose to rebel against the authority of Jesus Christ. Basically communicating the message, you can't blame your environment. You can't blame your parents. You can't blame the government. The reason you sin is because of Jeremiah 17, 9 and 10. The human heart is wicked beyond anything we can imagine. And so we see in the Bible multiple object lessons designed to teach us human beings. If I give you what you want, it doesn't go well for you. And so look what happened when people could live 900 years. People were killing one another left and right. And I think it's not just an object lesson for our benefit. I believe it's a benefit for the angels. We're told in the Bible that the angels are intently watching us to learn about God and the grace of God. And so I think these object lessons are not only intended to teach us lessons, they teach the angels lessons, both the righteous angels and the unrighteous angels. And who knows, God may have a dozen other reasons why he did it the way he did and why he waited so long to bring judgment upon those reprobate people. You know, that's one of the things I want to ask him when I get the chance. And maybe I'll be behind you in line, who knows.
Hugh, before you close in prayer, I want to say thank you to those here in person, Paradox Class. I want to thank everybody that's online. About 100 people watch us and join us live streaming. And then these classes are also posted on a YouTube channel. And within the next week, another couple hundred people will be downloading and watching this class. If you have questions, if you're downloading and watching this class later this week, if you have questions, feel free to put it on the comment section of YouTube, and we'll make sure that that gets answered. So thank you to all three of those audiences. Hugh, if you could close us in prayer.
Father in heaven, we do thank you that we live at a time where we can actually record high-quality video and audio what happens here in class. And we pray that the questions that are asked here, what's happening here in the class, would actually benefit people that are downloading off of paradoxes.org. So, Father, I pray that not only our words but our demeanor would be a blessing to everybody that's participating in this Paradoxes class. And, Father, I pray, too, that as we approach this Christmas season, you would bless us with opportunities to share the meaning of Christmas with people that we meet. In the process, we would see people receiving more of your love, life, and truth, and entering into a relationship with the Creator of the universe, Jesus Christ, that they would worship him as Creator, Lord, and Savior. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you.